calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds, I'm telling you. Welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour at the top of the program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and on CRN Digital on cable TV systems in 29 states. Welcome to our program. Andy Bernstein is with us. Andrew is the author of a new book, The Capitalist Manifesto. He also specializes in novels, objectivism, and business ethics with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And on Sunday night of this week, he will be on C-SPAN 2 at 10 p.m., speaking about his new book, The Capitalist Manifesto. Andy, welcome to the program.
Good to be back, Tom.
Great to have you here. Andrew, let's talk for a minute, actually let's talk for a segment here, about Social Security and Medicare.
Okay.
The people, we the people of the United States, got together and elected Franklin Roosevelt back in the 1930s. Well, we can just keep it to Social Security to begin with, because it came about at two different times. And Roosevelt said pretty openly that his agenda was all about the New Deal. He got reelected three times, in fact, based on this, and that we should have Social Security, that there should be a social safety net. And in fact, Social Security, not retirement insurance, fully a third of the people receiving Social Security are not retired persons, but the disabled people, people who, you know, orphans, widows, things like this. I'm assuming that folks from I know that the conservatives and the Republicans have been fighting this ever since the 1930s when it was first proposed, and Bush is still trying to deconstruct it. I'm assuming you're opposed to it as well.
Oh, definitely, Tom. It's a violation of individual rights for a paternalistic government to essentially steal money from productive working individuals against their will. So I think it's immoral and unjust.
And yet, what do we do, Andy? I mean, we had a situation back in the 1930s where the leading cause of death during the winters of 33 and 34 among people who were over 50 was hypothermia or hunger.
Well, don't forget, the Depression, I mean, first of all, the Depression is caused by Hoover's unrelenting interventionist policies in the economy.
You're talking about the Republican President Hoover's six in a row massive tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires?
No. Hoover has a reputation for being a laissez-faire. He, in fact, was not. Coolidge, who preceded him, was basically a laissez-faire president who lowered taxes significantly. Hoover's policies relentlessly was status, Tom, whether it was the Smoot-Hawley tariff or the
Smoot-Hawley was in response to all of this.
But it was in large part what brought about the stock market crash and the depression. But
Smoot-Hawley was passed in 1930 after the stock market crash.
But the market responded to the realization that the tariff was coming, that Hoover was pushing for, and there was no way to stop it. But I think the main point is that government intervention does not create wealth. It does. It's socialist principles don't.
But we're not talking about creating wealth here, anyway.
Don't give people a higher standard of living. Tom, history shows us that the more laissez-faire a society is, the wealthier it is. Now, the more statist or socialist a society is, the poorer it is. If that weren't true, then Cuba and the Soviet Union would have been rich, and the United States would be poor, and that's not the case.
If that's the case, then why do we have why are we 24th in the world in terms of infant mortality? Why are we 27th in the world in terms of quality of life overall? Why are we so far down the line if laissez-faire is the best way to go? And why is it that when we were the most laissez-faire during the what you might call the golden era of the robber, you wouldn't call them the robber barons, but I would, the Gilded Age, that we had the most widespread poverty in the history of the United States?
Well, I question those statistics and those claims, Tom. First of all, I don't know 24th, 27th. I haven't seen those statistics. But I'll say this. The countries that have the highest standard of living and the highest life expectancy and the lowest mortality rates in the United States and others are all the capitalist or semi-capitalist nations of Europe, North America, and the Asian.
I'm not arguing against capitalism,
Andy. All of them are close together.
Andy, I'm not here to say that I want the United States to become something, you know, that we should tomorrow morning imitate Fidel Castro in terms of the way that our government is run.
I know you're not a Marxist.
I'm not even remotely suggesting that, but I do believe that if we collectively, if we the people collectively get together and say, you know, we would rather not live in, I've done a lot of work in third world countries that are laissez-faire simply because the government has no means or ability to intervene, right? I mean, there's no money, there's no resources, the government is, a bunch of corrupt despots who are living off in the capital city in their mansions, and I'm working out in the countryside, and there is no government. It is absolutely laissez-faire. And you walk out the door in the morning, and there's, 20, 30 kids there with open sores and hands out begging. I mean, that's what laissez-faire brings, at least in my experience.
Well, I think you answered your own point. You called these rulers despots. That is, there's no political economic freedom there. I think the key difference between us, Tom, is that you believe in democracy, that is the will of the people or the majority, and I believe in the principle of individual rights, where individuals have inalienable rights, which neither the majority nor the government can interfere with. And in the
I actually believe in a middle point between the two.
But Tom, in the despotisms you're talking about, there's brutal dictators who suppress their people there's no protection of individual rights. You can't be an entrepreneur. You can't start your own company. You can't own your own land. The government seizes it from you. The countries you're talking about are military dictators, or in Mugabe's case, an old-fashioned Marxist dictator. There's no principle of individual rights in those countries. There's no political economic freedom. That's not laissez-faire. That's dictatorship.
Well, actually, that was my experience in India, which is the world's largest democracy.
Well, India is starting to move towards a more of a free market economy, and I think over the last 10 years, and I think consequently, India is living.
Well, it's not so much a free market economy. They're starting to move toward just, taking our jobs.
they're moving towards greater freedom in the economic sphere, which is very good for the Indians. The belief that
Indians have done well
everywhere but in India.
No. We agree on a couple of these points here, Andy Byrne. We're talking with Andrew Bernstein. He's with the Ayn Rand organization, AYNRAND.org. I mean, you and I agree on the fundamental that the ability to engage in free enterprise is a good thing, and it builds economies. And capitalism is not an evil thing in and of itself. What I'm suggesting is that you are, by arguing that we should do away with Social Security and we should do away with Medicare because they are violations of personal rights, I'm suggesting that you're overlooking the fact that we live in a society, that there is an us here. It's not all just me, and that we as a society have collectively agreed, and it's not called Marxism or socialism, and I don't consider it tyranny. We as a society have collectively agreed that we're going to put a social safety net under those among us who are the most vulnerable, because there are, 10-year-old kids who lose their parents, and there are people who lose who are incapable of caring for themselves, who don't have the intellectual capacity for whatever reason, or physical capacity to do so, and we're going to take care of those people. Why would you want to just walk away from them?
Two points I'd make. First of all, I don't agree, and other people don't agree, and we have the right to our money without the government stealing it from us. And second of all, for people who need help in a free society and a free market, it's not that they starve, it's that you have private voluntary charities who help people voluntarily with their own time, their own energy, their own money. They could even use rational persuasion to try to convince me and people who think like me to help them help the poor. The government doesn't help the poor. I mean, people living on welfare or on Social Security or, who God forbid, need Medicaid, getting very meager support. I mean, if you let people...
At least they're alive.
But, Tom, if you protect individuals' rights and let them keep their money, free men and women...
What if they don't have any money to begin with, Andy?
Free men and women can plan for their own retirement and medical care far better than the government can.
What if they have no money to begin with?
But like I said, in a free country, you have private charity. The welfare department has helped put private charities that appears.
So we should just trust the rich will take care of us.
Well, but in a capitalist country, Tom, so many people are rich relative to what the living standards are in the non-capitalist countries. I mean, America has proven over and over again as the richest country because it's the freest country in the world to be an enormously generous, charitable, and giving country. Look at the American Red Cross. They're all over the world whenever there's some kind of disaster or earthquake.
Well, Andy Bernstein, you're in a very articulate way putting forward the argument that George Herbert Walker Bush put forward with his 1,000 points of light, that George W. Bush put forward back in the 1970s when he ran for Congress on the platform of doing away with Social Security.
Tom, you don't have to insult me by comparing me to
no, but I mean, you know, it's they're using the exact same logic, and
but the Bush
you say it well.
Support capital.
Yeah.
I don't think they even understand it.
I agree with you. Andy Bernstein, he's going to be on C-SPAN 2 at 10 o'clock Sunday night talking about his new book, The Capitalist Manifesto. He works with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Andy, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's always good talking to you, Tom. Take care.
Ditto, Andy. Talk to you soon. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We're privatizing Medicare, it's history, and what will take its place will be a prime example of truly ample opportunity. Oh, there's a hefty deductible on all the drugs you need. And there's co-payments for sure. We're selling a cure if you're feeding our greed. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandma,
oh, yeah, Grandma, it's after the first of the year here. Good luck. Try to figure this one out. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking to you from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 440-THOM, 866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. And welcome back to our program. And our, by the way, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi to the folks there, as you will. One of the points that I wanted to just kind of rebut in absentia, and I'm sure Andrew wouldn't mind, because we've had this discussion before, and I just, you know, it's, we go around on this stuff, and it's, and the reason why I keep bringing these objectivists from Ayn Rand back on is because this is the philosophical underpinnings of the modern conservative movement. This whole idea that greed is good. It's what Ronald Reagan brought in, and, you know, and government is bad. I mean, Reagan came along, and you'll recall this was one of his favorite punchlines. He never got tired of this one.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
And everybody would go, "Ha ha ha ha! Yes, government is a terrible thing. We need to get rid of government." And until they actually do need help, until they feel that they've been taken advantage of, and they want to use the government court system to do something about it, or until they, you know, and on the list goes. But in any case, he made the comment about the government stealing our money. And this is the point that I got so tired of this. I got to tell you, back in the 2000 election, I think it was, or thereabouts, during that time when, in particular on faux news, you had Hannity and a couple of the other guys, but him in particular, just this mantra, it's your money, it's your money. And I am not, you know, here to say, gee, I think we should just tax people to death. I think, nobody likes paying taxes. Come on, I mean, you know, we're all human beings here. But the reality is that if I walk into a 7-Eleven and I say, gee, I really like that that Hershey bar there, and I pick it up, and I tear it open, and I take a bite out of it. At that point, is that dollar that Hershey bar costs, I don't know what they cost, let's say they cost a buck, is that dollar that's in my pocket, does it belong to me, or does it belong to the clerk behind the, you know, does it belong to 7-Eleven? And, you know, I think all of us get it, that if I was to walk out of the store with a candy bar in my hand and the dollar in my pocket, that collectively society, we'd bring the police in and say, hey, wait a minute, that dollar isn't your money. You made an agreement when you picked up that candy bar and walked out the store with it, walked out of the store with it. You made an agreement, even though you didn't sign any paper, you entered into a contract to buy that candy bar. And it wasn't your money anymore once you made that agreement. And we make an agreement every year that we continue to live in this country, to live by the laws of this country and by the rules of this country. And if we collectively get together in a democracy and say, you know, we are going to care for, you know, the orphans among us. I mean, literally the orphans. I mean, Social Security, a third of the recipients of Social Security are not retired people. We are going to care for the children who are abandoned with Down syndrome. We are going to care for widows and widowers who have lost the person who is able to provide their income. We are going to care for the least among us. If we as a society agree on that, and then we as a society agree that we're going to fund that with taxes, then I'm sorry, it's not my money. I have already agreed that a certain part of my money is going to be paid in taxes, and that's no longer my money. That's money that I am holding in escrow for the government until they deduct it from my paycheck. And whenever you hear one of these cons go into these rants about it's your money, what they're trying to tell you is that they don't believe in the social contract. They don't believe that there's a contract between us and us, between us individually and we as a society. And they're just not going to go there. And that's a terrible and tragic thing. It's one of the most destructive memes that is out there, one of the most destructive thought viruses that is out there. And so, anyhow, I just wanted to wrap that up. We're going to go into your phone calls right after this break. I also want to get into this thing with Sam Alito. We now have three Republican senators blasting George Bush in his effort to get around his torture ban, and the way he got around it, or is trying to get around it, is by having these signing notes, you know, when he signs a bill, adding his little commentary to it. And it turns out that the guy who first came up with this idea, that the president could do this in order to enhance his power relative to the legislative branch, Sam Alito. And Sam Alito is going to have to go before these senators. And I'll tell you all about that, too, as the show goes on, as the program continues. What happened last, was it last night on Letterman or the night before? Mr. O'Reilly was there, got night before last, got his clock cleaned. 27 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. The Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Judge Alito, we're going to get to that in just a moment. Mr. O'Reilly, night before last on David Letterman's program. A little strange here. David Letterman finally taking him to task. Here, just listen to this.
How can you possibly take exception with the motivation and the position of someone like Cindy Sheehan?
Because I believe she's run by far left elements in this country. I feel bad for the woman.
Have you lost family members in armed conflict?
No, I have not.
Well, then you can hardly speak for her, can you?
Right. I'm not speaking.
There you go. Another chicken hawk bites the dust. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. George in Coos Bay, Oregon, listening on KBBR. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. I saw that O'Reilly exchange on tape, and I thought that Dave just took him to the woodshed. He was very respectful and very serious, and O'Reilly must have ice in his veins. If anybody wants to see it, it's on a website called about.com, but you have to go politicalhumor.about.com.
It's also on the NBC website or is it CBS, whichever network. Yeah, NBC is the network that David Letterman's on. I saw it on the network website.
Great.
Letterman's own website. Yeah.
I had three questions about something that O'Reilly kept hammering at. Did Cindy Sheehan, number one, did she in fact say that the insurgents in Iraq are freedom fighters?
Here's the content. I'll answer them as we go through. Here's the context. She said, what Cindy Sheehan said, because Louise actually went out and looked up that quote after O'Reilly said that.
Yeah,
I tried to track it down. What she said was, if my country had, and I'm paraphrasing now, I don't have the exact quote right in front of me, but it was to this effect. If my country had been invaded, then I would want to fight back. I think most people, if their countries are invaded, want to fight back. And many of these people think of themselves as freedom fighters. They see themselves as trying to push out an occupying army. And
that answers
I agree with that sentiment, by the way.
Second question. Yeah. So she didn't actually call them heroic freedom fighters. She just said, that they, if we were in the same position, we would do that.
I can't imagine, I mean, just on the face of it, can you imagine a woman whose son was killed in Iraq by Iraqis calling them heroic freedom fighters? No.
No. It doesn't ring true.
Right.
Okay. Well, then that answers pretty much all my questions. She said something sort of like that, but I think O'Reilly lied.
Well, he took it out of context. I mean, they're very good at that.
I don't want to call the guy a liar or anything. Wait a minute, I lied. I really do.
Good idea, George.
Thank you very much, Tom, and keep the home fires burning.
There you go. You too. Good to hear from you. Chris in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to comment on the caller earlier how, he, like many people and like certain religions, they will cherry pick the Bible and or whatever their religious.
Oh, you're talking about Andy Bernstein with
Ayn exactly.
Rand.
Well, he wants to cherry pick certain, amendments and certain portions of the Constitution that support his thoughts, but he forgets when it says support, promote the general welfare. It says within the Constitution, because the framers themselves did understand that in order for us to be a better country, all of us have to be lifted up. Right?
Oh, yeah. The Constitution is clearly a social contract, and in fact, the Declaration of Independence is the first founding document of any nation in the history of the world to have the word happiness in it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But they don't want to live. They don't want to read the entire Constitution, just like most people don't want to read the entire Bible. They want to pick certain, we have the right to bear arms. We have the right to land. Yes, we do.
Yes.
We also have the obligation to promote the general welfare. That's why they put it in the preamble.
Yeah. Yeah, and Chris, good point. And this is where, again, I go back to, I remember reading Ben Franklin's autobiography, and he was talking about, thanks for the call, Chris, and he was talking about going to England and seeing all these poor people who were basically on the dole and railing against it. And in fact, conservatives very often quote Ben Franklin railing against what you might call welfare, because what had happened was, the government, the king of England, in order to prevent a revolution, was basically passing out what today you would call welfare checks to people, just barely enough to get by. Enough to get by, just barely. And people didn't have to, work based on that. And as a result of that, as Ben Franklin pointed out, they were creating multi-generational poverty. And so what you have to do is you have to look at it the way that Lyndon Johnson looked at it. Lyndon Johnson, with the war on poverty, reduced poverty in half in the United States, cut poverty in half in the United States in 4 years. And the way that we did it was by saying, okay, we're going to help you take care of your basic needs, those of you who don't have the means to do it, who weren't born into the Bush family. But then we're going to go a step beyond that and give you the ability to get out of that social class and into the next social class by giving you access to education, by providing low-income loans, for example, or free education, free public education, by leveling the playing field, by things like affirmative action programs, saying that colleges and universities have to take a certain number of people from these particular social classes, or in the case here in the United States, after 200 years, 300 years plus of slavery, of beating down African Americans from a particular group of people and say, we're going to give you a leg up for a while, not forever, for a while. until some sort of parity or equality is achieved. And the same with women, for that matter, in our society, because this had been, you know, a white male-dominated society all these years. And that's the piece that's missing when the cons trot this stuff out. Lee in Sacramento, California. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to, first of all, thank you for providing such intelligent debate. I completely disagree with the guy that you had on from the Ayn Rand Institute, but it was really great to hear him very articulately expressing himself and for you two to debate back and forth. I really enjoyed that.
Well, I also thought it was cool that he was making, almost with the exact same language, the argument that Bush Sr. made with his Thousand Points of Light speech and the argument that Bush Jr. made when he ran for Congress unsuccessfully back in the 70s. And the main thing he was running on was privatizing Social Security.
Well, one thing that he said I found so incredibly ironic, and I'd love to get your opinion on this. Conservatives are forever, always accusing those of us who have more liberal ideas of being idealistic, seeing society as some kind of perfect utopian place where we all take care of one another. And yet, your interview with him, he said that he felt that he was certain that the rich would take care of the poor. And I just thought that was so incredibly idealistic and ironic. What do you think of that?
I agree with you, Lee. It is noblesse oblige revisited, and that's the sad part about it. There's this concept that was used to promote kingdoms, hereditary hierarchy, and that was that the reason why kings and queens should continue to rule and their children should rule is because they would raise their children with the idea of the obligation of nobility to care for the little people. It's a, you know, noblesse oblige. And this is what the founders rejected. They said, I'm sorry, we're not going to depend on the rich and powerful to take care of society. We're going to do it collectively for us.
It won't happen.
Yeah, it won't. Well, historically, it hasn't happened, and it's led to some pretty messy situations like the French Revolution. Lee, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you. Great
to hear from you. I appreciate it. Meryl in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Meryl, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. I was concerned about Social Security, and is it possible to put it on every worker in the United States, including the government workers? And I'm in a
virtually tunnel. All government workers, Meryl, are getting Social Security. For example, your members of Congress, they get Social Security. I know that the conservatives are circulating emails around that everybody gets saying, did you know that Robert Byrd is going to retire with millions and millions of dollars? And it's not true. They get Social Security.
As well as a government pension?
Yeah, they get a government pension, but it's pretty much the same pension that the guys who are the janitors in the Capitol building get.
Wow. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I've had three different members of Congress on and asked them about this, and Bernie Sanders gets asked this about once every 3 months. And as far as health care goes, you know, they got a nice gym there in the Senate, but basically the members of Congress, the House and Senate, are given I don't want to call it a budget. It's a benefit, just like, you know, if you work for a big corporation, and they can buy health insurance, and most of them have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and that's it. And they have to deal with their health insurance company the same way you and I do. So,
except if a person has a really low income, they don't even have the ability to buy health insurance.
I know, and that's the tragedy. That's the real tragedy. Meryl, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tom, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Yeah, Happy New Year, Tom.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Hey, these Ayn Randers basically believe democracy is actually socialism. They really... That's why they hate democracy, because they believe it is an economic system of we the people and all of that.
Well, what they're doing is they're mixing up the economic system of democracy, of capitalism, with the political system of democracy.
Exactly. And they hate the idea that the political system of governance is superior to the economic. They just can't stand that. They want to flip it over the other system.
Well, it's not so much that they don't believe it. I mean, what we're talking about here are idealists and people who, I mean, true believers.
Well, you know,
keep in mind,
really,
you know, Alan Greenspan is part of this bunch.
They believe in mercantilism, no competition. We Democrats believe, like Elliot Spitzer, New York Attorney General, said, we believe in true free markets, competition for small business. We are the party that supports with regulated capitalism.
That's right. Okay. Because if you have laissez-faire capitalism, absolutely unregulated capitalism, then you're going to end up with the big fish eating not just the little fish, but the medium-sized fish, and all you have left is a half a dozen companies running everything. And that's clearly the direction we're going. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So many lonely people, damn the stroke of dreams. Yes, I know it could be better to say that about anything. Some got it worse than me.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination and maybe clean elections once in a while. Just to wrap up the thing about Congress, personally, I think that we should have a national health care system. It should be absolutely universal, and whatever you and I have, it should be what our members of Congress have. You know, that said, no, the reality is they do have, you know, a very good health care. They have very good health insurance. But it's, you know, your basic health insurance. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. I want to get back to this McDonald's versus McDonald's thing. Some folks emailed me yesterday and asked me to repeat that. First, Brian in New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Great. What's up, Brian?
Hi. You're talking about Judge Alito, and I believe he really wants to further increase, if that's possible, President Bush's wiretapping powers to allow President Bush to go even further against his political enemies. And down deep inside, Judge Alito knows this, and President Bush knows this. And there's been stories on the air that they say that now, that for years now, Al Qaeda has not used even the internet. They've long stopped using even cell phones or even computers to relay messages. Instead, they have employed couriers for the last 4 or 5 years at the least.
Oh, they have pretty much from the very beginning. I mean, this is the old fashioned way. It's reliable. It works. And then the lower levels, they'll go into one of the things that we had an ex-CIA officer here on the program, and he said that they were discovering that these guys were going into, like, Japanese gaming rooms, you know, where there's literally, you know, a 500,000 of these gaming rooms out there that are running continuously at any given moment, and, you know, with Japanese teenagers playing games, and in real time, and they just drop in there and get a pseudonym and communicate in code.
Right.
And it's impossible to track. I mean, it's too much of it.
They were saying that at that the most that our own intelligence experts, our own NSA and CIA, FBI, civilian air patrol, everybody has been saying that most that the intercepts by the NSA have only captured it riffraff.
Which brings us to the point, Brian, and thank you for the call, because you put a nice point on that pencil here. It brings us to the point of, number one, Bush doesn't need to go unconstitutional. He doesn't need to trash the legislative branch of the government in order to be able to, he doesn't need to violate the law, and he doesn't need to ignore judges in order to be able to eavesdrop to the extent that we can eavesdrop, number one. And number two, there are simply practical limitations on what we can find, which means that to think that we can live in a world where we can just do whatever we damn well please, and the rest of the world can take a leap, and we're just going to keep taking their oil whether their people want us to or not, and we're going to keep exploiting their labor forces whether the people there want us to or not, and I Claudius, this whole idea of the imperial United States is tragic and destructive. This is a profoundly dangerous notion. You know, before the election of 2004, back a year or so ago, actually about 2 years ago, I guess, right after the invasion of Iraq, you had all these neoconservatives on, and they were talking about, in articles in like the National Review and things, is it time to bring back the I word, or the E word, rather, empire, and talk about the American empire. And why don't we just come right out and say, we're an empire? And I'm sorry, when traditionally empires start calling themselves empires, that's about the time that they stop being empires. That's when they start to implode. We had the entire world in the palm of our hands, or at least shoulder to shoulder, arm to arm with us the day after 9/11. Even the Muslim world was horrified by what had happened. I would venture to guess that even Osama bin Laden realized that he had overreached. He had shot himself in the foot. If Bush responded to it appropriately, it would have been the end of Al-Qaeda. Because Muslims were looking at this going, this is absolutely wrong. And turning against the United States. Candlelight vigils in the streets of Tehran, Iran. I mean, all over the Muslim world, people in solidarity with the United States. And if George Bush had simply responded to this the way that Bill Clinton responded to the Oklahoma City terrorist incident by saying, you know, there's a sick person out there, there's some sick people out there behind this, and we want the cooperation of all the police agencies all around the world to track them down and prosecute them. We need to bring them to justice. If they had simply done that, if he had simply said that, we wouldn't be in this mess. And we wouldn't have more terrorists looking at us going, hmm. I mean, keep in mind, bin Laden back in the 90s came out and, I mean, he had been our friend, remember? We helped fund him when he was in Afghanistan. Not that he needed a lot of help from us, you know, multimillionaire himself, but you know, we helped see him set up shop as the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to throw the Soviets out. And then when he wasn't needed throwing the Soviets out anymore, he went back to Saudi Arabia, a Bible-thumping or Koran-thumping fundamentalist, and he looked around Saudi Arabia and he said, you know, we got a problem here in this country. There's this creeping secularism, and not just in this country of Saudi Arabia. It's all over the Middle East. There's too many secular governments, governments that are not run by the mullahs, that are not run by those who know what to do because God told them to. And so he organized his little merry band who had successfully thrown the Russians, the Soviets, out of Afghanistan and massed on the border with Iraq to throw out Saddam Hussein. And his own government said, you can't do that. We don't want to have a war with Iraq, thank you very much. And they deported him to the Sudan and stripped him of his citizenship. His own government, Osama bin Laden. So here's this guy. He's like, you know, he's been kicked out of Saudi Arabia. He's trying to get everybody's attention, and he says to the United States, "Okay, now you guys are the ones who are corrupting Saudi Arabia. I can't go after Saddam Hussein, so I'll go after America and get your guys out of our bases. You got men who are shaving their beards and drinking alcohol, and women who are voting and driving cars and showing their elbows. We can't allow that, and they're on Saudi soil." Well, George Bush last year went along with it after he was, you know, kissing Prince Faisal, and said, okay, we're going to pull him out. And we did pull him out. But, I mean, Osama's two demands were, number one, get the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia. Number two, get the price of oil up to the point where you're not ripping off our country. I mean, as long as we're engaging in policies where people around the world see us as imperialists, we're at risk. And that puts us at greater risk than our ability or inability to competently wiretap. At the bottom of it all. Anyhow, in the next hour, this is extraordinary. I want to find out what happened in Serbia. We're going to talk about the Serbian elections with a guy who was actually there. Rich McClure is going to be on, and we're going to get into the talk radio news. And then I want to get into this whole thing about Alito and how he set this all up. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Benjamin Franklin, a quote that has been reinvented dozens of ways, hundreds of times, over and over again throughout time. And speaking of liberty and safety, our guest here in this first segment, Rich McClure. Rich brings 40 years of journalism, technical, and management experience to projects he works on. He's been in media since 1975. He managed the pro-media media assistance programs in Albania, Slovakia, and Yugoslavia for the International Research and Exchanges Board, IREX. He's familiar with the USAID management frameworks, part of the team that founded KAXE in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, served as first president founding manager of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska. And I should, as a disclosure, say Rich also participates in the management of KUDO, 1080 in Anchorage, an Air America affiliate radio station that carries this program. Rich, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good morning.
Great to have you on. I mean, the reason I asked you to come on this program is we have these conversations about, you know, what really happened in Serbia. And I was talking about this on the air a couple of days ago with the elections there and these guys from Serbia who went out and replicated their efforts in the Ukraine. And you were like, no, I was there. Let me tell you about this. I was so amazed. It was such a great story. I wanted you to share it with our listeners. Tell us what happened. First of all, why did the United States intervene in Serbia?
Well, I think the United States and the rest of Western Europe was concerned about what had happened in Bosnia. They had watched what happened in Bosnia over a period of 5 years and then watched what happened in Srebrenica with the massacre of thousands of innocent civilians. And then they saw the same thing perhaps happening in Kosovo and then the possibility of the same thing happening later in Montenegro and Macedonia. And I think the European Union was also concerned, frankly, about a lot of refugees coming into Western Europe from a place very close by. And so they decided to do something about it. Part of it was proximity, the fact that there were satellite dishes and people could see what was happening in Kosovo and earlier what happened in Bosnia, and mm-hmm. they decided they had to act on it.
I remember watching, you know, on TV news, people being shot at in these various cities, and they couldn't, you know, refugee. I mean, it was right in our homes and kept saying, you know, why doesn't Clinton do something about this? And finally we did, ultimately.
Yeah, and, you know, and it was a hard decision for some of us working on the project, too, because I normally don't believe that the United States should be involved in overthrowing another government. But I had worked in the Balkans since 1993, a lot of, with Kosovo refugees in Albania. And it just got to a point where I looked at it, my wife and I were working on this project, and the project was to basically help people get information so they can make independent choices on what to do. And at some point in the process, we said, no, we got to go beyond this. Milosevic could cause yet another war. This is a bad thing. And so I guess we went against some of what our own beliefs were, was that the United States shouldn't involve itself in other people's governments, and we were involved in a process that brought down Milosevic.
Well, World War II is another example. These are the exceptions that prove the rule, I guess, you know, the times that it's important to take that step out. So the election, Milosevic was setting up. He was preparing to steal an election. And you were involved, or at least an observer, in noticing, observed, you were there, watching the election get unstolen?
Yeah. Well, what happened was Milosevic timed the elections right after the Olympics. And the reason is that Radio TV Serbia, which is Milosevic's TV arm, had exclusive rights to cover the Olympics. We tried to get the Olympic Committee to accept B92 reporters. B92 was the primary independent radio and TV service in Serbia, although Milosevic...
Now, you were working with B92?
B92 was a radio station that started as a student station.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, during the demonstrations against Milosevic in 96 and 97, this little student station grabbed over a million listeners because they were the only ones covering the demonstrations, and everybody knew they were happening.
Right.
So even pro-Milosevic people... who had to go from one part of Belgrade to another, listen to the station because they knew where the demonstrations were and where they couldn't drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this little student station...
Now, this is the station that ended up being blown up, right?
No, Radio TV Serbia ended up getting blown up.
I see. Okay, pardon my interrupting you, Rich.
Station.
Okay, yeah, okay. Carry
B92
on.
Was shut down by Milosevic, and what we did was we helped them stream on the Internet. And then we went around, Susie and I went around to community stations around Serbia outside the borders and convinced them to rebroadcast B92 news back into Serbia. So a station in Bosnia, a station in Romania, one in Hungary, all rebroadcast B92 news streamed from the Internet. And they were operating from five different apartments out of computers because if one got raided, they could just continue to broadcast.
How cool. So Milosevic is preparing to steal the elections.
Yeah. And we had polls that showed Milosevic could very easily lose the election. And Serbia has a rule that if the president doesn't get a 50% vote in the first runoff, in the first run, then there's a runoff. And so we were pretty sure, Milosevic was pretty sure that he might come in second in the first round, but no one would have 50%. And so therefore, he would steal it in the second round. Well, what happened was we put out, we being the democracy group that worked, we had people from the U.S. Democratic and Republican parties, the AFL-CIO, Land O'Lakes Cooperative, Dairy Cooperative, people who are used to working with community groups, and Susie and I doing media. And we worked with these civil society groups. And we organized an election that it looked like Kostyanitsa could actually win. And what we wanted to do
being
sure
the good guy
had the results.
Kostyanitsa was the good guy, the pro-democracy candidate.
Kostyanitsa was a mild nationalist, a pro-democracy candidate, not the greatest guy in the world, but certainly he was not a warmonger like Milosevic.
Yeah, a war criminal for that matter.
So I suppose we could say that remains to be seen based on what happens in The Hague, but I got no doubts about it.
Yeah. So the election is held, and Milosevic is going to do like the Bush administration did right after the election here in 2004, and blanket the airwaves with, "Hey, we won. No need to pay any attention to those exit polls." I was saying on the radio the other day, and you said, "No, wait a minute. They weren't exit polls."
Yeah. Okay. First of all, we did one thing beforehand. We got a number of public service announcements that just said 1 + 1 = 2. Demand a fair count. And so 1 + 1 = 2 ended up being graffiti on walls before the election. So people were primed because we had a group of students, student activists who went out and graffitied Belgrade and the other major cities with just 1 + 1 = 2.
The numbers.
The numbers. That's all.
Yeah. And everybody understood that meant we want a good count on this election.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what happened was the U.S. Democratic Party organized poll watchers in every precinct in Serbia. And so what happened was people would go to vote, and as soon as the votes were counted, there were paper ballots, as soon as the votes were counted, what they did was they took their mobile phones and text messaged the results into the media center in Belgrade, which our program and George Soros had funded, and or else use faxes if they didn't have text message. And by 10 o'clock, the media center had compiled results that showed that Kostyanitsa got more than 50% of the vote. And they put it out on the Internet and on the streaming of B92 on the Internet. We picked it up on a satellite dish in Bosnia and rebroadcast it into Serbia by satellite. A number of small independent community stations around Serbia outside of Belgrade, which Milosevic hadn't shut down because there were just a number of them, broadcast this information. And people believed it.
And
what was important.
And that was the end of Milosevic.
What was that?
And that was the end of Milosevic's power.
Not quite.
That was the beginning of the delegitimization of it, shall we say.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, what happened was some of the Otpor groups, which are the student activists, set up large screen televisions in main town squares. And so people would actually gather and watch the results on these large screen televisions. Also, they had music videos prepared with major rock bands in Serbia, and their music videos were "This Time We Won't Stop," because what happened in 97 was Milosevic stole elections or tried to steal elections, and there were demonstrations on the streets for about 70 days, and then finally they petered out. And so these music videos were all ready to go, "This Time We Won't Stop."
Wow.
And so as soon as people heard the results and believed them, the demonstration started.
Now, Rich McClure, we only have 1 minute left. Why didn't we do this in the United States last year?
I have said a number of times that if Florida had happened before the election in Serbia, Milosevic would still be in power, and there might have been two more Balkan wars.
Yeah. And so there are some clear lessons, I think, for activists in the United States out of this. You know, we need to get a good network. Yeah, don't stop. 1 + 1 = 2. We need to have a slogan. We need to have a logo. We need to get the message out. We need to build a good infrastructure of alternative media out here.
And the important thing was don't stop. I mean, the demonstrations went solidly from the 24th of September to the 5th of October when Milosevic finally stepped down and recognized the results. The demonstrations didn't stop, and that was crucial.
Yeah, and boy, somebody needs to knock John Kerry upside the head with that message.
Exactly.
Al Gore tried. I mean, he at least took the thing to the Supreme Court, went to the Supreme Court. You know, George Bush sued him. But
they were the ones that had the demonstrations in Florida, all those congressional aides. It wasn't
the right-wingers. You're right.
Yep.
It was Tom DeLay's entire congressional staff down there banging on the windows. Rich McClure with KUDO and 1080 in Anchorage. Thanks, Rich.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets.
Indeed, here we go, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, where we run rings around the right wing every day. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. I guess I already said that, didn't I? Welcome back, my friends. Greg Gorman is with us. He's with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brilliant website, fine institution, and some great reporters in Washington, D.C. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, always good to be with you, Tom.
Always great
especially
to have
after
you
an
here.
Intro like that. I really appreciate it. We all appreciate it.
You guys are just great. You and Victoria and Ellen and just the whole bunch. We're so pleased to have you part of this program. What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, a few things, the first of which is this morning in the White House, as you may have heard. Now, the president met with a bipartisan group of former secretaries of state and defense. And this was widely seen around the White House, especially as a way for him to broaden his view and his outreach and to, you know, break that shell of him only relying on his inner circle.
You mean broaden the perception of...
Which is what I was about to say. We in the briefing room, however, understand that this is the perception of a broadened outreach, because even though a few of the secretaries, you know, came out on the lawn or onto the stakeout and spoke to us, you know, it was pretty true that they did not have, let's say, the highest hopes for, you know, being listened to by the White House, even though they said that they would, and, you know, they left the meeting saying that the president is willing to hear them not only at the meeting but after the meeting. There aren't a lot of people around the White House who expect them to really be able to take a call from the president and say, hey, you know, hey, am I doing the right thing in Iraq?
Yeah. So this is a photo op, basically.
Well, you know what? Right. And the other thing that's interesting is this afternoon, Chuck Schumer, who is actually, you know, he's going to be busy because he's getting ready for the Alito hearings next week. He's actually going to have a call today with the press, and he's going to unveil his own economic report. Later today, Secretary Snow is going to give out an economic report that's going to say that the economy is good and continues to be good. And Chuck Schumer is going to say that he has a report that shows that on the boards, across the board, you know, most Americans who don't live above their means don't think the economy is as rosy as the president has been saying it is.
Yeah, well, most Americans, it's not a matter of whether they think it or not. Most Americans are not living the economy that's as rosy as Bush says. I mean, if you're a millionaire or you're a billionaire, things are good. You've got a huge tax cut. You're only paying a 15% maximum income tax rate. You're not paying Social Security, you know, after the first 80, 90,000, whatever the cap is nowadays, 100,000. If your income is 6.5 or 7 figures or greater, things are really, really good for you right now. But if your income is 5 figures or less, you're in trouble.
Well, right, and that's what Chuck Schumer is going to say today, saying he has numbers that show if you are just a normal American who goes to work, who tries to support your family, that the real state of the economy is not what the president has been saying, that, you know, it was great on one hand, and two, he should be getting credit for how great it is. And that's what the senator is trying to do today.
We're talking with Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Greg, the Financial Times is reporting that the Bush administration has decided that rather than turning to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which we are a member of and with whom we've signed treaties, saying basically we will not engage in warfare without approval of NATO and participation of NATO, that rather than turning to NATO for future conflicts, we're going to create our own coalition of the willing, and simply go with them. Is this a story? Has this story hit Washington, D.C. yet?
It has not, but I did hear someone in the briefing room talking about it pretty much under the guise of, look, we went into war. There was no resolution by Congress, and this is the president's way of now getting around NATO. You know, there are a lot of people in Washington who think that the president has been going around making up his own laws, and now this is another way for him to go into war or, you know, stay in war without having to have the backing of Congress. As a matter of fact, Tom, you probably heard he made a large number of recess appointments last night in advance of Congress coming back in, and that's yet seen as another chance for him to do what he wants without Congress in session. And today Scott McClellan said it was only because those were important positions, and they had to be filled.
He's thumbing his nose at Congress here. I have a list of these guys here that he just these recess appointments. I mean, the Constitution says that when the House and Senate are in recess, in an emergency, the president can fill a position. But these are not emergencies. He Floyd Hall of New Jersey to be a member of the Amtrak Reform Board, or Enrique Sosa of Florida, member of Amtrak Reform. But I mean, these are not emergencies. But maybe Gordon England of Texas to be Deputy Secretary of Defense. I mean, you know, what's the deal here? These are probably mostly political appointees and political hacks and political payback, and he didn't want to have to be accountable to this. Peter Carsonow of Ohio to be a member of the National Labor Relations Board. I mean, NLRB is pretty important. Hans von Spaskow of Georgia to be a member of the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission. In fact, he appointed four members to the Federal Elections Commission. I mean, what, is he planning on stealing another election?
Well, you know, and Tom, that's exactly why Scott McCullough was asked this morning, why did he do this? Because, you know, we all know that the wording says it should be in an emergency. And that's why Scott McCullough answered back, well, we know these are very important jobs, and they need to be filled, trying to say it is an emergency when we all know it's not.
Scott, it's got to be tough to have the job of being a professional weasel. You know, it's just got to be tough.
I hope he gets paid a lot.
I hope so, too. Greg Gorman, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Greg, for being with us today.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will be cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Place for being progressive. Never felt so good. The Tom Hartman radio program. This is just amazing. This report coming from the Financial Times, the first to report this, and they apparently actually interviewed an official who asked not to be named on Tuesday in Washington, D.C. This is a story by Guy Dinmore in Washington, D.C., published in the Financial Times. And the Financial Times is to the United Kingdom what the Wall Street Journal is to the United States, more or less. And, you know, it's a conservative business publication. And here's the story. I mean, just building on its experience in Iraq, the Bush administration says it wants to be able to form coalitions of the willing, and that's in quotes, coalitions of the willing, more efficiently for dealing with future conflicts rather than turning to existing but unreliable institutional alliances such as NATO. And then they quote the senior State Department official who shared this in this briefing on Tuesday. We ad hoc our way through coalitions of the willing. That's the future, said a senior State Department official in a briefing this week. He would not say whether such planning was being made with Iran in mind. Are you starting to get worried? He questioned the reliability of NATO. Now, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO is made up of democracies. And this is the incredible thing about democracies. In the history of modern civilization, there has never been a time when a fully democratic nation, when a democracy attacked another democracy. Well, period. Doesn't happen. And the reason why is because when the people are really in charge, they will always choose peace. There have been times in democracies attack dictatorships, and there have been times when dictatorships attack democracies, but democracies don't attack democracies. It's a very self-regulating thing. There have been a half a dozen books written about this. You'll find, actually, there's a couple of chapters about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? In fact, it's burned into us. Democracy is in our DNA. It's absolutely a part of us. People say, well, no, we need to be like animals, you know, the hierarchy, like in the animal kingdom. when I was writing What Would Jefferson Do, I interviewed one of two scientists, Tim Roper and a person by the name of Conrad. And Roper was the one I interviewed. They did this study that was published in the journal Nature out of the University of either Sussex or Essex. I always confuse the two. But one of those universities there in the United Kingdom, to get published in the journal Nature is a big deal. I mean, this is one of the top peer-reviewed scientific journals on the planet. And everybody had always assumed, I'm talking scientists, everybody else, had always assumed that in the animal kingdom that there was hierarchy and that, you know, we're animals, we're part of the animal kingdom, there should be hierarchy among humans. That the world of kings and princes and lords and barons and baronesses and duchesses and all this, and all the way down to serfs and peons, that was replicated in the animal kingdom. That had been our mythology. For 7,000 years of civilization, that's been our mythology. The alpha wolf, the alpha the alpha male, and we always assumed that the lead animal ran the crowd. Darwin assumed this. Everybody assumed this, and Conrad and Roper said, "What if it's not true? Or what if it is true? I mean, nobody's ever tested this." And so they set up some cameras to look at a herd of red deer who lived near the university. And the deer could, there were several water holes nearby, and the deer could, they had to make decisions collectively. I mean, it's a herd, right? They had to make a decision. When do we stop grazing and go drink? And when we go to drink, which drinking hole do we go to? Now, these are not small decisions, because if they graze too long, some of their members may become dehydrated, particularly the younger or the old among them, and it could be life-threatening. If, on the other hand, they don't graze long enough, some won't get enough nutrition. How do they know when to move? And how do they know which water hole to go to? If there's a predator in the area, how do they know, you know, what's the safest path? Who makes the decision? The assumption had always been that it would be the alpha male, the largest, meanest, toughest, baddest of the males among the red deer. So they set up these cameras and they watched. And what they discovered was that the deer would be standing around in all these different directions, kind of chewing their cuds and grazing, you know, eating grass. And when it more or less came time to go drink, when the time that the herd typically moved, but it would, you know, plus or minus whatever time, that randomly throughout the herd, animals would start, just as they're chewing the grass, they would move so that their heads were pointed in the direction of one of the three nearby water holes, casting their votes. And when 51% of the animals were pointed toward one of the three water holes, suddenly, spontaneously, and without anybody saying, you know, hey, heads up, the entire herd would just start heading toward that water hole. And very often, the alpha male standing in the back going, hey, where'd everybody go? They discovered that there was an alpha male, but the alpha male had no leadership authority. He only got first pick of sexual partners. So Darwin was right about, you know, survival of the fittest, and Richard Dawkins with the selfish gene. I mean, that stuff is right about selection of sexual partners and sexual, you know, propagating the strongest genetics. But in terms of decision-making for the group, it's done democratically. And when they published this, when I interviewed Conrad, he said after we published this, he said he started getting all these phone calls from zoologists and biologists all over the world who were saying, you know what, you saw with the deer, I see this. We see the same thing with our gorillas. We see the same thing with our birds. They're doing like slow motion. You ever watch a flock of birds? And you notice how they don't turn like a semi-truck on the highway where the lead bird turns and then they all kind of curve around behind him. No, they all turn at the same time. Or a school of fish. It's not like the lead fish turns and then the rest of them follow him, curving around the corner. It's not that way. They all suddenly turn at the same. How do they do that? We used to think maybe they had telepathy or something. And it turns out that their peripheral vision is really, really fast, as is ours, by the way. You can spot the flicker of a fluorescent light with your peripheral vision. You can't with your central vision. It's slower, the color vision in your central vision. With their peripheral vision, they're all noticing the motion of all the people around them, all the fish or the birds around them. And when more than 51% have moved a quarter inch to the right, boom, the entire flock moves a quarter inch to the right, and then another quarter inch, and then another quarter inch, until you have this smooth motion. They are voting sometimes thousands of times a second. And they found that this was true of gnats. You ever seen a cloud of gnats in the air? You know, these little tiny mini, like fruit fly kind of things? And it's like a ball of them, and they just kind of move around? They're all voting. Insects. I mean, it's in our DNA. So George Bush comes along and he says, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to be part of a coalition of democracies where everybody gets to vote, and where a country like Amsterdam, which the Netherlands, that just said, no, they don't want to be part of the action in Afghanistan. You read where a teacher in Afghanistan was just put to death for teaching girls? So Amsterdam says, you know, we're out of here. Why? Because the people of Amsterdam, the leaders of Amsterdam are convinced that if they take it to a vote, the people of Amsterdam will say, no, we don't want to be any part of this. It's democracy. So Bush says, no, we don't want democracy. Instead, what does he want to do? He wants to go with a coalition of the willing. The U.S. official, again, quoting from the Financial Times, the U.S. official singled out non-NATO allies in Asia, such as Singapore. Last time I was in Singapore was about 5 years ago. I was giving a speech. I was doing actually a workshop on how to make schools that work. It was for a group of educators. And we were talking about schools and how to reform schools, and somebody asked me the question from the audience, what should we do here in Singapore? How can we get these kinds of changes in our schools? And I said, get politically active. Get out there and start talking to your politicians. Start talking to the newspapers. Start pushing, you know, try to get people elected who will make these kind of reforms. And it was as if I had farted out loud. I mean, the room just suddenly went silent and everybody got rigid. And afterwards, one of the people who put the thing on came to me and said, you know, you don't talk about politics here in Singapore. I was staying in one of the top hotels. This group had put me up, and they put me in a 5-star hotel. I was staying in one of the best hotels in Singapore. I went back to my hotel room about 4 hours later. We went out to lunch 4 hours later. Everything in my hotel room had been ripped apart. The drawers had been taken out and emptied. The bed had been ripped apart. Somebody had gone through that room in a way as if to say, we know you're here. And this is the country that Bush wants to have as an ally rather than democracies of NATO. No, we don't need no stinking democracies. I'm telling you, this and these appointees, these recess appointments that he just made, George W. Bush is thumbing his nose at democracy. Are we going to allow him to continue to do this? We can't! 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When the world has turned you down, dear, I'll be waiting. When your friends can't be found, I'll be there.
Indeed. Welcome back. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Here in the Real Free Speech Zone, the radio, the Tom Hartman radio program.
When you have
9 minutes before the hour.
Please come on home.
But wait, there's more. I was telling you about democracy and the fish voting and the birds voting and the red deer voting and the gorillas voting and the gnats voting and it turns out even ants are voting, right? The bees, I mean, you know, just right through the animal kingdom. I don't know if anybody's looked at the vegetable kingdom yet. I suspect there's probably something similar going on there. Probably has to do with pheromones. But in any case, all the votes that they initially looked at, they were all of these species were hitting like the 50-51% threshold. And then they found that with the red deer, they found that there were sometimes when they'd go 55-60-65%, it would hit 66% and then 67% before the crowd, the herd, moved. And the question was, what's different? Why is it that sometimes it takes a supermajority, two-thirds, rather than a simple majority, just one person more than half? And they discovered that that was when there was a predator nearby. When the stakes went up in the animal kingdom, we're talking about red deer here, when the stakes went up, the vote, instead of a 50% vote, it took a two-thirds vote. And the founders of this country wrote into our Constitution, if you want to amend this Constitution, it takes a two-thirds vote. There's a whole bunch of things, actually, that require supermajorities. And this is what Bill Frist is trying to knock down. I mean, the Democrats are saying, hey, you know, we want 60 votes, 60 out of 100 in the United States Senate. That's six-tenths. That's four-fifths. It's not quite two-thirds, but it's close. It's more than half before we're going to go along with a Supreme Court nominee. I mean, this is really important. It's a lifetime job. And they're saying it because they know deep down inside, I mean, their instinct is this is the right thing. Because it is burned into our genes. Democracy is burned into our genes. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, good day to you, Tom. I wonder what you made of the comments by Mr. Gingrich this week that Tom DeLay should have stepped on permanently as majority leader of the House.
I think it's just good politics. I mean, he was looking at it in terms of, let's have the Republican Party move on.
Right. But I think also that he was remembering, Mr. Newt is remembering that Mr. DeLay actually tried to oust him in a coup a while back, which we don't...
Well, there's that, too. Yeah. DeLay and Gingrich hate each other and have forever. I mean, you know, DeLay ended up winning that ultimately, and Newt left.
Right. But having said that, I still think he's right to say it, because I think DeLay does have to go. He's about the most corrupt, maybe with Cheney, the most corrupt politician I've ever seen at any level of government in my lifetime.
Yeah, and perhaps in the history of this country at that level of office. Yeah, absolutely. Rick, well said. Thank you. Steve in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I still would love to hear more and more discussion of the impeachment.
Yeah, well, what it's going to take to impeach George W. Bush is a...
What it takes is the voice of the people to overthrow this government. And my problem is with you because you do not discuss the voice of the people enough. It is the voice of the people saying impeach, and you do not discuss it. I got right through because nobody's listening, because they only want to hear impeachment, and you are not discussing it.
Hang on just a second, Steve. I'm confused. You got right through what you said. I discuss impeachment on this program all the time. I keep saying, in fact, if you want to have a serious investigation of George W. Bush, it's going to take getting rid of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, because you can't have bills of impeachment put forward unless the Speaker of the House will allow it to come to a vote. Ain't going to happen.
I disagree. Have you heard of House Resolution 635? Have you discussed that resolution?
Are you talking about John Conyers' resolution? Yes, I have discussed that.
Okay.
And, yeah, in fact, I've discussed it probably a half a dozen times.
Good.
I'm all in favor of it. And I'm telling you, John Conyers will tell you, he has been on this program and we've discussed it, it's not going anywhere. Why? Because the Republicans control the House of Representatives. Steve, if you want to get George Bush out of office, step one is to show up at your local Democratic Party office and say, I'm here to help. Let's get Democrats elected. Let's get the Republicans out of office.
I call three times a week to my representative in Congress demanding impeachment. I have been for the last umpteen months.
Steve, they can't do it until the Democrats take back the House. It's that simple. I mean, simple math. John Conyers is going to be on this program next week to talk about this very issue. In fact, he's already booked.
Can I shift gears just a second? Let's discuss the meaning of the word neoliberalism and their economic policies.
Yeah, I'd rather not, Steve, right now. I'm sorry. It's just some other time. Alice in Humboldt County. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Okay.
Hi, Alice.
I know it is very hard for most people to believe. I have no question but that our White House planned 9/11 and made it happen. They then appointed a commission to cover it up. If they would invade countries to gain political power, and you believe they did just that, then they would do just about anything.
Well, I don't disagree with you, Alice, that they would do just about anything, and I would like to see a good, serious, real investigation.
It breaks my heart to see what's happening to our country.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know.
I'm sorry,
Alice. The 9/11 commission doesn't even say one word about the Building 7 coming down.
Yeah, I know. It's not even mentioned in the book. And in fact, we had one of the commissioners on this program, you'll recall, and I asked him about it.
Keep fighting.
And he just didn't know. Yeah, thank you, Alice. It's great to hear from you. Alice in Humboldt County, 91 years old and still kicking out there, still being a political activist. God bless you, Alice. We need a country full of you, folks like you. And so much appreciate your calling. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We will be back again tomorrow, same time, same place. Oh, wait a minute. We got another hour to go. I'm way ahead of myself. We will be back after the news at the top of the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interests. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Christiane Amanpour. Is the Bush administration bugging her? Is this a conspiracy or a coincidence? Indeed. It turns out that the Andrea Mitchell of NBC had asked James Risen in an interview yesterday or the day before if he knew whether or not Cheney had been wiretapping CNN's Christiane Amanpour, who, by the way, is married to, Robert Rubin? I believe, or Jamie Rubin. She's married to a former Clinton administration official. In any case, Andrea Mitchell, who is married to Alan Greenspan, it all gets very, it's almost like America's royalty here. Anyhow, Andrea Mitchell asks Risen if Bush was eavesdropping on Christiane Amanpour. The transcript gets put up on the NBC website. It gets into the blogosphere. The blogosphere freaks out. Hey, look at this. And so NBC pulls down the transcript. Pulls down the transcript. I mean, it's starting to get interesting. And now NBC says, and for a while they just kind of tried to pretend that it didn't happen. And now they're saying that there's an ongoing investigation. NBC has an investigation, and they are not ready to say anything, basically, about what they're finding and whether or not. Well, here's the story from TV Newser. Yesterday, MSNBC.com published a transcript of Andrea Mitchell's interview with author James Risen about the CIA's domestic spying program. In it, Mitchell asked Risen if he'd uncovered evidence that CNN correspondent Christiane Amanpour was eavesdropped upon. And this afternoon, MSNBC removed the portion of the transcript that referred to Amanpour. In a statement to TV News user Tonight, NBC explained why. Quote, this is the NBC's official statement on the thing. Unfortunately, this transcript was released prematurely. It was a topic on which we had not completed our reporting, and it was not broadcast on NBC Nightly News nor on any other NBC News program. We removed that section of the transcript so that we may further continue our inquiry. Very interesting. By the way, today, in this day in history, the Hartford Convention was convened. It was an event during the War of 1812 in which New England talked about seceding from the United States, and out of which came the Federalist Party, the official Federalist Party. I mean, prior to that, people referred to themselves as Federalists, but this was when the actual party itself got kicked off. And James Madison was president, and people were very upset with Jefferson before him and him with the Embargo Act of 1807, the Non-Intercourse Act of 1809, basically laws that reduced foreign trade and strengthened domestic industries. And the wealthy merchants of Boston in particular were not happy with Jefferson and were not happy with James Madison. And so they got together, the Hartford Convention on this day in history, in 1812, got together and talked about maybe seceding from the United States. And didn't happen. 26 delegates, fascinating story. Anyway, to more pressing issues of the moment. There's some stuff in the news that is just, this is the turning point for American democracy. I'm telling you, this is absolutely it. George W. Bush, well, let me back up a little bit. John McCain came out and said, over and over again, the media all over the place came out and said, if we start, and I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, if we start torturing people, first of all, we're going to get lousy information. It's not the best way to get information. It's the least sophisticated and actually least effective, it's just a lousy way to get information. You don't get good information that way. But even worse than that, if we start torturing people as a matter of public policy, then every other government around the world will say, okay, we can do that too, and we will be leading the world away from democracy and away from human rights rather than toward democracy and toward human rights, which has been, up until the Bush administration came into power, McCain wouldn't put it that way, but I will, had been, by and large, the history of the United States, one of more rights and stronger democracy rather than fewer rights and less democracy. So when George W. Bush, so McCain attaches this to the defense appropriation bill, that first he tried to simply say, we're just going to have a law that says that we have to go by the Army manual, which says you don't torture people. But then the Bush administration goes in and they change the rules in the Army manual. They change the language in the manual. So then McCain says, okay, we'll make it explicit. And they attach this piece of language that specifically said that cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of detainees by all U.S. personnel anywhere in the world is categorically prohibited. So it passes into law. And Bush, never having vetoed a law, doesn't want to start with this one, signs it. But when he signed it, he attached to it a little bit of language. He'd come up with this idea. It's called an interpretive signing statement. He attached his signing statement to the law, in which he said that he was, it's like setting up, it's, you know, you're talking about working the rest. It's like setting up the interpretation in advance, knowing someday this is going to end up in front of the courts. He's making the argument to the court even as he's signing the law. This is what the signing statement said. It is very brief. The executive branch, that's the president, shall construe Title 10 of, in Division A of the Act, in other words, this part of the law that says that you can't torture people, relating to detainees, in a manner consistent with the constitutional authority of the president to supervise the unitary executive branch. Now, the word unitary does not appear in the Constitution. But there is this new bunch of guys out there calling themselves Unitarians, got nothing to do with the church, who basically are arguing for bringing back royalty and kings. And they say the executive branch is unitary. So anyhow, it will be exercised consistent with the constitutional authority of the president to supervise the unitary executive branch and as commander-in-chief and consistent with the constitutional limitations on the judicial power. In other words, I'm signing this law, but I'm telling you, Judge, you don't have the right to stop me, comma, which will assist in achieving the shared objective of the Congress and the President, evidenced in Title 10, of protecting the American people from further terrorist attacks. In other words, the whole piece of this legislation, the whole point of this legislation is to stop terrorist attacks, and therefore anything that I say as President of the United States, if it's going to assist in protecting people from further terrorist attacks, I can do even if it violates this law. Now, this is, some would say, nuts. But it's not the first time George W. Bush has done this. He's done it, in fact, 108 times as president. The first president to do it. attaching these signing notes, these interpretive signing statements to legislation when he signs it. Where did he get this weird idea that he could prejudice a judge or a court by interpreting the law as he's signing it, when the job of the judiciary is to interpret the law, not the job of the president? Where did he get this idea? Turns out he got this idea from Sam Alito. This is on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Article by Jess Braven. In November 2000, while the nation fixated on whether George Bush or Al Gore would emerge victorious from the electoral confusion in Florida, Judge Sam Alito laid out his view of what powers the future president would hold. The Constitution makes the president the head of the executive branch, but it does more than that, Judge Alito said in a speech at the Federalist Society at Washington's Mayflower Hotel. The president, he said, has not just some executive powers, but the executive power, the whole thing. Judge Alito, Jess Braven writes in today's Wall Street Journal, was describing the theory of the unitary executive, an expansive view of presidential powers that he and his colleagues set forth while working in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Reagan Justice Department. Although the Supreme Court has not always agreed, he said in his speech, quote, I thought then and I still think that this theory best captures the meaning of the Constitution's text and structure, end quote. So here we have the guy who started the idea back in 1986, first wrote about the president should attach an interpretive signing statement to any law he signs, asserting his power, is going to be our next Supreme Court justice? 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Only thing that changes is my mind. I never could toe the mark, and I never could walk the line.
And welcome back, my friends. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. I'm telling you, this is Judge Alito's view of the presidency, expansive powers. Front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Endorsed theory of far-reaching authority, tenant of Bush White House. Adherents to the theory, called Unitarians, reject the view that regulatory agencies should operate independent of political control. Now, this is where this is. Let me make some sense out of this. The Bush administration received about $250,000 in donations from coal companies in West Virginia. In exchange for that, they put the guy in charge of the regulatory agency. Now, this is operating under the executive branch, under Bush, right? Works for Bush, of the Mine Safety Agency, the group, the agency that's in charge of mine safety. They put in charge of this a guy who had spent 30 years as a manager in the mining business for a company that had about twice the number of workplace injuries of the industry average. And we see the results of this in part now at Sago Mine. But the Bush administration is saying that they can appoint political hacks to regulatory agencies. They can appoint the brownies to FEMA because George says so, because he has a unitary authority. Kings have unitary authority. Presidents don't have unitary authority. They have to follow the law. But that's not what Sam Alito said. Samuel Alito, back in 1986, came up with this theory of the unitary power of the executive branch. And these guys call themselves Unitarians. It's got nothing to do with the church. Again, quoting from today's Wall Street Journal, some believe only that Congress cannot create agencies or officers that operate outside the president's direction. Others contend the president has executive powers beyond those granted by Congress or listed in the Constitution. And they're talking about Bush administration lawyers. They say they contend that the unitary nature of presidential power over national security meant Mr. Bush could not be constrained either by treaties or laws passed by Congress that govern treatment of enemy prisoners. In other words, he doesn't have to pay attention to the laws of the United States. Michael Frumkin, a law professor at the University of Miami, quoted in today's Wall Street Journal article, says some people would argue that the whole point of the revolution was not to have a king. Yeah! But, as Jess Spraven writes in the Wall Street Journal, Judge Alito, a Federalist Society member who currently sits on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, noted in his 2000 speech that as judge, he had had a few occasions to rule on presidential authority. He observed that what the executive power encompasses has always been very hotly debated. He noted that the Supreme Court has not exactly adopted the theory of the unitary executive, instead taking a two-track approach. Yeah, like the legislators make the laws, the president has to follow the laws. The judiciary interprets the laws or makes sure that the laws are enforced. Alito is a little concerned about this. He thinks that the president should just go for it. And then the Wall Street Journal notes this article by Braven. He says, in the landmark 1952 steel seizure case, the court rejected President Truman's claim. That was a Democratic president during time of war, during the Korean War. Truman's claim that as commander-in-chief, he could take possession of steel mills then closed by strikes to ensure production of arms for the Korean War. The opinion by Justice Hugo Black defined the president's commander-in-chief power narrowly. Quote, even though theater of war, he wrote, may be an expanding concept, end quote. In 2004, again, I'm quoting from the Wall Street Journal here, in 2004, the Supreme Court cited the steel seizure case to rule that prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and others the president designated as enemy combatants have a right to challenge their detentions in court. So the Supreme Court up until now has said the president can't act alone. He doesn't have unitary power. The presidency is not unitary. It is one part of a three-part government, three branches of government, the judicial, the legislative, and the executive. He can't do that. But Alito's saying, sure. February 5th, 1986, he drafted this. He's his interpretive signing statements. The idea was to flag constitutional concerns and get courts to pay as much attention to the president's take on a law as to the legislative intent. He later added, this is quoting Alito, by forcing some rethinking by court scholars and litigants, it may help to curb some of the prevalent abuses of legislative history. In other words, reduce the power of the legislature, increase the power of the presidency. I mean, this from Jose Padilla to the concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay to George Bush being able to appoint people to the Federal Elections Commission, who should be confirmed by Congress, but he says, oh, no, Congress took a vacation for the holidays, so during the recess, I'm going to make recess appointments to the Federal Election Commission, the group that oversees our voting machines. Bush just made three appointments to the FEC and the National Labor Relations Board as well. He says, oh, I can just do this. Why? Because I'm king. Georges Rex. It's wrong, my friends. It's wrong. This is a scary time for democracy. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Robot dog, give me live in the moment. Don't get too far ahead, don't live in the past. I've been my eyes and the moment is over. I guess another day has passed.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, here it is. I'm right here in the Wall Street Journal today. You just come right out and say it. That the advocates differ on the degree of executive authority. Some believe only that Congress cannot create agencies or officers that operate outside the president's directions. Others contend the president has executive powers beyond those granted by Congress or listed in the Constitution. And And in fact, you know, they could basically come out and say, you know, the president for example, if Congress says that he has to appoint somebody who's concerned about the environment to be head up the EPA and he'd rather appoint somebody who isn't, he could do anything he wants. It's not a matter of competence. It's a matter of power. And thus we find Jack Spadaro. Jack Spadaro was the director, was the director of the National Mine Safety Academy, the MSHA's National Mine Safety Academy. And he said that the Labor Department's opposition to vigorous safety regulations had hindered his work, or their work. He said the inspectors were telling him this privately. Quoting here, he says, 2 weeks before this explosion, this is from the Duluth Superior newspaper up in northern Michigan, 2 weeks before this explosion, I was told by an inspector, Jack, there's going to be another disaster because we can't do our jobs. Now, this is not, you know, I'm not saying here Bush is the source of all evil or that George Bush is the cause of the mine accident or the explosion or anything like that. But the simple reality is that that the workplace can be a dangerous environment. The history of America is people dying in the workplace. I mean, it's a major part of the story of America. To this day, people die in the workplace on a relatively regular basis in the United States. And we, the people, have collectively decided that we want to pass laws to create agencies and institutions within the government that will make certain that the probability of somebody dying on the job is minimized. So we created, for example, by an act of Congress, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA. And George W. Bush puts in charge, and, you know, like we created FEMA, too, you know. And so here we have a mine, 21 citations last year for a buildup of combustible materials. Now, this is, you've all heard, you know, there's a couple hundred citations last year. 21 of them were for a buildup of combustible materials at that mine, according to U.S. Labor Department statistics. This is an act, the Mining Safety and Health Act was signed in 1977. Mining deaths dropped from 425 in 1970 to 85 in 2000. But as Phil Smith, the communications director for the United Mine Workers of America, is quoted today in Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org, said that while citations have been issued, the fines assessed for safety violations are too small to force large corporations to make improvements. The problem with the current laws, he said, is enforcement. According to an AFL-CIO analysis, the Bush administration cut 170 positions from Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration and has not proposed a single new mine safety standard or rule during its tenure. And why? Well, according to the Washington Post, West Virginia coal firms raised $275,000 for Bush, and as a result, well, we can't say it's definitely as a result, but let's just say and. Last September, Bush rewarded the coal industry by placing coal industry veteran Richard Stickler in charge of MSHA. Now, this is a guy who spent 30 years with Beth Energy as a coal company manager. Mines managed by this man who is now in charge of mine safety for the U.S. government. Mines managed by him over the last 30 years had worker injury rates double the national average, according to government data cited by the United Mine Workers Union. The highest penalty of the more than 200 citations received last year by the Sago mine, $878. Most of them, $60 to $250. I mean, no wonder we can't leap to saying they're running an unsafe mine. Although I suppose you could argue that the fact that an explosion occurred means it was unsafe, you know, on its face. And now we're getting these tragic stories. Some of the 12 coal miners who died following an explosion left notes behind, assuring family members that their final hours trapped underground were not spent in agony, a relative said Thursday. This is from CNN. The note said they weren't suffering, they were just going to sleep, said Peggy Cohen, who had been called to a makeshift morgue at a school to identify the body of her father, 59-year-old mining machine operator Fred Ware, Jr. She said the medical examiner told her notes left with several of the bodies all carried a similar message, your dad didn't suffer. Cohen said her father had a peaceful look of someone who died from carbon monoxide. The sole survivor is still in critical condition. One of the, I don't have the story right in front of me right now. I've read it yesterday. One of these miners carry these contraptions that allow them to breathe, that give them about an hour's worth of oxygen. I believe they're called self-rescuers. And one of the proposed regulations that the Bush administration has set aside over the last 5 years is to upgrade the self-regulators. We have this technology. I mean, you know, in the space shuttle, they're not breathing outdoor air. It's just a little more expensive, that's all. A little problematic. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Linda in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Linda.
Hey, good afternoon.
All of the above. Somewhere.
I appreciate your show.
Thank you, Linda.
I'm glad WPTT put you on.
I am, too.
I'll make one comment about the mines, then. I'd like to talk about our third senator from Virginia, who thinks he's from Pennsylvania. My family, my grandfather, my father, brothers all were in a mine at one time. And I'll never forget something my grandfather said. One time they had an explosion. They all come running out of the mine. And my grandfather had, was either a horse or a donkey, I don't know, whatever they used at that time to go in.
Mm-hmm.
But he came out without the animal.
Mm-hmm.
So the mine foreman said to him, where's your horse? He says, I left it. I had to run and get out of there. He was told, I can get 1,000 men like you. That animal cost me money.
Yeah.
And people should never forget that, because the attitude hasn't changed.
Well, it's Linda, this is the point I try to make on this program over and over, and that is that the only thing that is standing between us, between an American middle class, and us going back to the Gilded Age where we had basically labor bosses and terrified workers, the only thing that's standing between us is organized labor.
Yes.
And it's an absolute tragedy that the United Mine Workers Union has been reduced to a shell of what it was before Ronald Reagan declared war on organized labor in 1981.
Well, a lot of young miners are choosing to go to non-union mines, and that's terrible.
A lot of them don't have a choice. I mean, it's just the labor department has made it so hard for unions to function, and the mining companies, they get out of these union contracts by simply declaring bankruptcy and walking away.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I mean, it's incredible. So, anyhow, you said you wanted to say something about your senator from
Pennsylvania. Yes, he was on IMUS this morning.
Which senator is this?
Santorum.
Oh, Rick Santorum, okay. Yeah.
As I said, my third senator from Virginia.
Yeah, he lives in Virginia, but he represents Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, he was, I guess, IMUS asked him a question about the president breaking the law. And, of course, Santorum didn't recognize that.
Yeah.
And Santorum made a comment. He says, used to say that some judges who are appointed by either a Republican or Democrat president has better knowledge of the law than the president.
Oh.
Now, what kind of a cop? Oh. You're talking about someone thinking of kings. They must all think of.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Linda. I mean, this is where we're at. I mean, we're at the mentality of royalty.
the mentality for him to make a why don't we just get rid of the Constitution, the judges, get rid of the senator, because if we have a king, we don't need one of them.
Well, I'm telling you, that's the direction these guys are taking us. Linda, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
I don't think anyone picked up on it, is what's so sad. Every time
really?
Howard Dean makes a comment, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
This is more disastrous than anything Howard Dean ever said.
Yeah, you're spot on. You're spot on. Well said. Linda, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us there on WPTT in Pittsburgh. Amazing. why wouldn't the president know the law better than a judge? After all, he's just a judge. Oh, my. I'm telling you, my friends, it's time to get politically active. There's only 11 months to go before the next election. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I am a rebel soldier, and far from my home.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy in West Virginia. Could it have been averted? Is it in any way simply a reflection of the mindset, this royal mindset of, I'll take care of my buddies, whether it has anything to do with what's best for the United States or not? It seems increasingly in my mind that it is. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont, up there on Lake Champlain. I've driven through your town. Jeff, hey.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. How you doing today?
Great. Great to have you, and thanks for listening to WVAA there.
Yeah,
what's
I
up?
Love you. I love your program.
Thank you.
And listen, you bet this could have been prevented. They deregulated this industry so much, not just this industry, but every industry.
Yeah.
They put power in the hands of a few people, and they've lost their values, and it reminds me of an old Sinclair Lewis novel or Dos Passos stuff where people were talking about some of these issues in the 30s and the 40s.
Oh, yeah. Have you read It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis?
Oh, yeah, I have.
I spent a year trying to acquire the rights to that novel from the heirs of him, from his family, to write a modern version of it.
Right. He went very right wing at the end of his life.
Yeah, I know.
But can I just say this? You know,
sure.
You know this better than I do, but what I want to say today is there's an entire unspoken history in America, like our real history in the 20s and 30s, about labor rights. And it went so far, and you probably know this figure better than I do, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but during the 20s and 30s, people were so concerned about these things that, like, I would guess maybe 25% of Americans considered themselves socialist.
Oh, yeah.
And they all come from...
My grandfather called himself a socialist.
Right.
Made my father crazy.
And
still does
to
this day.
And he was kind of a conservative guy.
He was actually an immigrant from Norway, but same difference.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? He probably was just concerned about workers' rights.
That was it.
And democracy.
I mean, he came over here in 1917, and there you go. And in fact, it's not just the 20s and the 30s. I mean, you go back to 1880s, 700,000 workers struck just in the year 1886.
Yep.
I mean, you had the big B&O Railroad when they cut their wages
this
in
was
Baltimore.
Democracy,
you know, 40 people were killed in 1887 just during this one strike. You know,
yeah, this used to be democracy where people thought about these things, and it's a very short time ago. It's in your grandfather's lives, my grandfather's lives.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, Jeff. Well said. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Appreciate the call. You too. Good to hear from you. It's amazing. Kate in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Kate. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
I had a comment on the fines you were talking about for the infractions and the mines.
Yeah.
My husband was flipping through the channels last night, and we accidentally bumped into CBS Evening News. And one of the reporters on there, Bob Schieffer, was asking him questions, and he mentioned that there had been infractions. And I'm paraphrasing here. But he said, well, you know, the largest fine was only $850. How bad could they have been?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we
so
know that 21 of
these fines,
right,
they're actually trivializing these safety infractions and things like that. I mean,
yep.
it,
Ooh. And we know that 21 of these infractions specifically had to do with combustible materials in the mine. And guess what? We had combustion.
Exactly.
It's an absolute tragedy.
But they were just blowing them off, you know, on the evening news, like, you know, oh, well, they couldn't have been that bad. It was only this much money, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's insidious.
Yep, I agree. Kate, thank you very much.
Fascists out of here.
Yeah, we do, which means we've got to get, we can't just sit back and say, I'm going to wait for November 5th and vote. We've got to do more than that. We've got to get active. Kate, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
As to the miners, what's wrong with this country? Why don't we have safety modules that go in with them that'll accept 20 to 30 miners and protect them, no matter what falls in on them or whatever, till they're ready?
Well, that was my point. You know, we certainly have the technology for that. It's just that the mining companies don't want to pay for it, and the, you know, conservative administration like this is certainly not going to force them to.
Well, I'd rather pay for that than pay for the CEO salaries that don't want to pay for it.
Yeah, well,
and
you and I are singing from the same hymnal here, Armin, but we often do.
Right, and quickly.
Yes, sir.
Are the Republicans effectively creating case law that says any illegal acceptance of evaluation monetarily is that creates a federal law violation? That federal law is null and void if you simply give to charity. Is that what they're doing effectively?
You mean by returning money from Jack Abramoff?
Right. Are they?
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to do. You got all these senators, and there's a few Democrats in there, but almost all, the vast majority of them Republicans. And now the Bush administration, out of the over $100,000, I mean, Jack Abramoff back in 2003, you know, 15 months before the election, says, well, I've raised $120,000 for George W. Bush, and I haven't even started making phone calls. And the Bush administration says, okay, we're going to return $6,000 of this. Yeah, right. It's like the bank robber after the bomb goes off and sprays the money with purple paint, you know, saying, well, I think I'll take the money back. Don't think so. Eve in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Eve, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Listen, something I haven't heard mentioned that I'm very concerned about, in this domestic spying case, people are asking, well, why didn't he get permission? I think the point is, with data mining, you don't have to have a name. It is so powerful. It is so evil. You can just put stuff in, like, wherever the word Bush comes.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is actually a separate thing from data mining, Eve. I mean, this is a whole separate thing. I mean, we're talking about specifically wiretaps in this case. But data mining, yes, absolutely. It's a huge and insidious thing. And the main way that the Bush administration is getting around rules on data mining is by having private corporations do it. They've outsourced it. They're outsourcing this stuff to private companies who don't have to operate under the transparency rules that the federal government has to operate under, or at least had to operate under until George Bush came along and started taking them apart. And, you know, it's also one of the reasons why you've got the second largest army in Iraq, a private army. They have outsourced that, too. We'll see you again tomorrow, my friends. Same time, same place. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.